ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Let's get into the segment known as Motor Talk. Garage door is up.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby is a professional motoring writer. He also undertakes paid contract work for various brands as an individual and in his business as well. This commercial work is entirely separate from his editorial reviews, and he has, as always, maintained accuracy and fairness in all his reporting and has full editorial independence across all content he produces. Toby, good evening to you. Welcome back, and how you sounding these days?
Well, I'm sounding all right, I think.
You are sounding okay. Toby and I were just down in the car park, and because Toby was showing me a new sound system, my innards have just sorted themselves out. This was a new sound system in a thing called a Cadillac, which I thought was a brand that had sort of
died off, making a comeback.
Well, died off with Scrooge McDuck, but anyway, they're making a comeback. And this sound system, I must say, was whoa. Sound systems in cars are different, aren't they?
They're very different. Yeah, I mean, it's they used to very much be an afterthought. They'd put the car together and then say, "We'll pop a couple of speakers in, sometimes four," and it was they were pretty ordinary quality. It was just a way to listen to the news or whatever else. These days, the top end sound systems, which are across all brands, I mean, literally your mainstream brands all the way up to the top end brands, all these days have some premium sound system options, and they are engineered in the car from the start.
They never used to be, did they? I mean, once upon a time, until relatively recently, I'm thinking, I mean, I don't know, was it the early noughties, really, when cars started?
Pretty much, late 90s, early noughties.
Because up until then, you used to go to a car audio store.
Yeah, and upgrade it yourself.
And you'd rip the old radio out, and you'd buy yourself a new one, and you'd stick it in the slot.
Yeah, I used to.
And then
you'd
buy yourself some speakers and put those in the back parcel shelf.
Yeah, that's it, the 6x9s in the back parcel shelf. I used to do that, and then you could get the rear window shaking.
You put the subwoofer in the boot.
I used to put two subwoofers in the boot. But yeah, it was, that was pretty much what you did. But 1983 was the first time a car company, which was actually Cadillac, put an aftermarket sound system, or I guess a branded sound system, and that was Bose. So it was a pretty basic system. I think it had four speakers, but it sort of kick-started this trend, which, as you say, it wasn't until the sort of 90s and early 2000s that we started to see it take off. And some of the early brands onto it, Volvo, for example, was getting into them pretty early on. Audi was one of the good ones. But I remember listening to some of the early, in the 90s, say, BMW sound systems were pretty ordinary. Merc sound systems were pretty ordinary. These days, they've all got some terrific ones. And from, 2000s, mid-2000s onwards, they all started stepping it up enormously. And as I said, these days, Hyundai, Kia, Toyota, Mazda, they all have some models with some reasonably good sound systems in them.
It seems to have coincided with an improvement in sound generally. I mean, I'm of that lot that grew up with, hankering after hi-fi systems and, six-foot-high speakers and all that sort of stuff. Now, I'm not saying those things aren't still great. They are, but no one needs them anymore, really, for a household to set up. I mean, people have, little speaker boxes that just stream stuff at a pretty acceptable level.
Yeah, that's right. And I spoke to one of the car audio engineers who made the point. He said most people do most of their listening in the car.
Yeah.
So while, you might love that home sound system, the reality is you're probably going to listen to more when you're sitting at 50 or 60 k's an hour. So it's and funnily enough, the car audio systems, they do create challenges for engineers. One of them is weight. So, big speakers with good bass and so on, you need decent magnets in them. So they're heavy. They tend to be fairly heavy. The last thing car makers want to do is add weight to the car. But they've given up that, I guess showed that, they'll make that compromise to get some decent sound systems in there. But the other thing, a car's got an advantage over a house. Every house is different. So every house, you've got to sort of tune the sound system in to some extent to the house, whereas with a car, you're buying brand A, model B, they know it'll be the same in every one, so they can tune the entire system for that car, albeit with the compromises of things like engine noise and so on, but they can still tune it for that sort of thing.
Hey, Scott's had an old, you used to have an old Cortina, Scott. G'day, how are you?
G'day, mate.
Tell us about the Cortina.
Oh, no, my uncle had a Ford Escort.
Oh, okay, sorry, Escort, yeah,
Escort,
go on.
Escort panel van.
Yep.
And he was a Led Zeppelin, here I hope, like an old 70s headbang by the metal heads, as you say.
Yeah.
And he had house speakers in the back. He had an amp of some sort. I mean, now I know it's an amp. I didn't know what it was. It had lights coming up with it. They had shag carpet, and he's let me and my older sister have control of the volume. It was something else.
That's right. You used to buy separate car amplifiers. That's right. You used to buy amplifiers you'd stick in the car. That's right, yeah.
I don't know. It was like half a house. They had house speakers, so I don't know where the amp come from, but it worked. And it had shattered windows. We'd pull up at the top of the trap at the intersection, and then people would be looking at us, and me and my sister would be laughing their heads off, and the uncle's there, and he was just sitting there unfazed, like.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Thank you, Scott. That's nice memories, mate. The shagpile carpet in particular, I like in the Ford Escort. Thanks, Scott.
I think it was Miranda. I think the name of the speaker, the old...
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, got it. Thanks, mate. It's good on you. Yeah, nice memories. 1-300-800-222 if you'd like to grab hold of Toby. Simon and Trevor, back to you in a sec. Just back on car audio, though. It's a selling point now, isn't it?
It is a selling point, absolutely. Yeah, and this is something the car makers have all realised. Not only, some of them will offer premium systems, particularly in the luxury brands. They'll generally put a very good system in there, but then charge you $5,000 or $10,000 more for a premium system.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, across all brands, they're finding that people want some form of decent audio. So no, it is definitely a selling point to try and get something better in there.
Streaming's made all the difference too, hasn't it? Because
you can take your whole album with you. Your whole collection.
Yeah, I had a car once that had six
CD.
CD stacker.
Yeah,
you fed them in, and whether they ever came out again, it was always a question.
That's right, and you'd hit a decent bump, and it'd stop the music and all that stuff. But streaming's made an enormous difference. So that's allowed people to take their entire collection with them. So,
who's doing the best of it at the affordable level, do you reckon?
Well, I think there's sort of two or three main companies. So Harman is one of the big ones. Mm. It's actually owned by Samsung, and they have an enormous array of brands under their umbrella. Not only Harman Kardon, Bang & Olufsen, Bowers & Wilkins.
Yeah, Harman Kardon's Scandi, isn't it?
I think so.
I think I started, yeah.
Yeah, and then... it's JBL.
But they've got what? Bang & Olufsen, Bowers & Wilkins.
Yeah, and Bowers & Wilkins, Bang & Olufsen, Harman Kardon.
So a lot of premium brands.
Yeah. Infinity, JBL, Lexicon. They've recently taken on Marantz, Denon, and a few others. So it's so they have an enormous part of that market. You then got Bose, which is sort of independent, and it provides them to a whole bunch of different brands. So they've, a lot of different brands from mainstream, Mazda and so on, all the way through to Porsche and others will use different Bose systems. But funnily enough, the quality changes depending on the car company. So your Mazda system, for example, it's decent. You get up to the Porsche Bose systems, they are a lot better. So basically, they put in a better system. Obviously, the budget's bigger in a Porsche, so they can spend a bit more. So in terms of the best ones, some of my favourites would be... that one that I've got down there with the Cadillac is certainly right up there. Mark Levinson does some amazing systems in Lexus, and they're exclusive to Lexus. The Lexus LC's got an amazing system. The Porsche Bose systems, Volvo with Bowers and Wilkins has an awesome system. Range Rover with Meridian, BMW iX with Harman Kardon is one of the better systems out on the market for sure. Tesla is pretty good at the mainstream end of the market, and that's unbranded. So Tesla went out famously and ended up poaching engineers from some of the big audio companies because they didn't want to pay the branding, the licensing fees.
Okay. Yeah. All right. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Mark is on the line. G'day, Mark.
How you going?
Not bad.
Hey, Toby, I used to work with your dad at Phillip Island during the motorbikes, but however, car audio. I've been in car audio since 1982.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah.
some of the big systems we'd put in where I used to work was unbelievable. I can mention a Yamaha head unit with a Bose system, and it had these 3-inch triangle speakers in a Renault, and the sound was unbelievable.
Oh.
And now here I am fixing old car radios still.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Not much installations, but more repairs now.
Okay, I was going to say. So there's okay. You say you're still there are still people who want their old ones fixed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fixing anything from 1937 up till 2000, and, and the work is just unbelievable at the moment.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Far out.
What if you mean people's old radio cassette player systems? You're still
Radio cassette, CDs, 8-tracks, the occasional record player, Philips record player that sits under a dash in a Volkswagen, and a couple of those.
Wow.
1937 Rolls-Royce passenger radio out of a Silver Ghost.
Oh, yeah.
The car's here in Melbourne. But, yeah, it's the work is pretty good.
One of the coolest things I like with some of those old systems, you know, Becker, for example, is an audio system known for Mercedes. Like Mercedes-Benz used to use them exclusively many years ago, decades ago. And what you're finding these days is, and you can get old Commodores and so on. So people who've got older cars, but they want to upgrade the technology in the car, but still keep it looking like an old car. So what they do is create they keep the fascia, they keep the front of the old sound system, but then put all the guts of a new one behind it, including Bluetooth and a whole bunch of other streaming features and that sort of stuff. But it looks cool. It's in that retro style. So that's another one that works really well for some of those older cars.
Yeah, Mark, and back in the old days, there used to be one speaker under the dash, wasn't it? Near the steering wheel, usually.
One speaker under the dash, LJ, LC, Toronto, 1/16 speaker under the dash on a bit of wood. The rest of them were up bolted, screwed up under the dash in the vents up the top.
Yeah.
Wow.
Speakers in the kick trims, which sounded pretty average. One speaker in the back and one speaker in the front, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah, good stuff. I'm glad you're still on the tools, Mark. That's great.
A couple of them, and I've got a couple of units here out of the old Pontiacs and the old Cadillacs. A speaker up in the middle of the roof.
Yeah, wow.
Where the interior light is.
Good stuff. Thanks, Mark. Nice memories. Appreciate it. Thanks for the call. 1-300-800-222. Simon wants to talk about actual cars rather than car systems. G'day, Simon.
Yeah, g'day, Phil and Toby. How you going?
Yeah, pretty good.
How's it go? Yeah, my questions are in about the Audi Q5. We're looking at purchasing probably in the petrol variant, and what it would be like if compared to its rivals, and timing as well in terms of purchasing it in a financial year, and given that there's a lot of people going towards electrification, whether the deals might be on the petrols.
Yeah, cool. So I actually have not driven the updated Audi Q5. I was chatting to Audi today, trying to book into one, and that's going to happen shortly. But they did point out there's a model year update coming in the next few weeks. So there's a minor update, and they're going to wait until that one's lobbed before I get behind the wheel. So unfortunately, I can't give you a whole lot more info other than what I've seen online and so on. In terms of the deals and petrol and all that sort of stuff, all of it comes down to all the end of financial year deals that you'll see now, basically. Anything that's got red hot deals on it is when they've got a few too many kicking around, when they're trying to clear stock. Car makers aren't generally too generous. They don't go just applying a discount for no reason, so they do it if they need to clear the stock. I haven't looked specifically on that car in terms of whether there are hotter deals at the moment on the petrol versions. But you'll find that, keep in mind, the car companies are pretty good at looking forward and determining, you know, what they think the demand's going to be. So, you know, with something like that, they're not going to bring a whole heap in if they don't think they can sell them. So I wouldn't expect there to be a massive amount of them sitting around on grass that they're trying to offload. But you never know. If that happens, as I said, look for the deals and you'll see that anything with those deals is where you find they're typically overstocked.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that there's looked to be a minor update, because I thought that car was relatively new.
It is, So it came out last year. So that's a new generation car that came out last year. But this is a model year update, so it's very minor. You're going to be talking, you know, sometimes it'll be minor spec sort of stuff. I don't think it'll be anything to do with styling. It'll just be to do with spec. So it's, you know, they might say, oh, for the model year 27, I think they'll call it 2027. It'll, you know, they might say we'll add this feature in for that particular year. So it's it's not going to be a wholesale change. It'll still drive the same. It'll still do all of that. It'll just be a very minor update.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Fair enough. Thanks a lot for that.
Thanks, Simon. Cheers. Good on you. Cheers. Yes. Belinda wants to buy a Ford Everest. G'day, Belinda.
Hi, Toby and Phil. Last year, I was thinking about the Ford Escort, just before I get onto the Everest. we had a four-door Ford Escort, and we actually put speaker boxes and screwed them down to the parcel shelf. That were from out of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a banging system in that.
Did you have the shag pile carpet?
No. We had purple carpet, though. It wasn't quite shag pile, but it was... Anyway, last year's Ford Everest, 2025 sports model, I'm looking at one of them. I know 90% of them around are turbo diesels.
All of them are. So they only do a turbo diesel. Are you talking four-cylinder or six or V6?
Well, that's the thing. I want to know which would be the better one. Excuse me. The 3-litre or the 2-litre?
Yeah.
3.3-litre or the 2-litre? And, they're a similar price to the four-door, what are they called? Ford. What do they call their utes?
Oh, the Ranger?
Yeah, they're a similar. You can get them for a similar price, but I just want to know which one of the two is better.
You mean between the 2-litre and the 3-litre or between
the Ranger.
The Ranger. So I guess ute versus SUV, you probably know they're essentially the same car underneath. There is one big difference, which is at the back end. So the ute gets leaf spring rear suspension, whereas the Everest gets coil spring rear suspension. So the Everest is a bit more comfortable on road. The Ranger has a bit better load carrying capability, basically. So it's and the trade-off is not quite as good in terms of its handling and the way it settles. But in terms of tossing up between the ute and the SUV, it'll really come down to how you're going to use it. I mean, I would only go for the ute, really, if you think you're going to load up that tailgate a fair bit and if you've got some heavy stuff to carry, because, you know, keep in mind with the ute, you haven't got much space in the car. If you go and do your weekly shopping, for example, and you want to take four people with you, then that's not really going to work. And if you want to, you know, take bags to the airport, again, they're going to be either out in the open, out the back, or in an SUV, you can have them undercover. So that's, as I said, I'll be looking at how I'm going to use the car and probably tend you towards the Everest in that regard. In terms of the 2-litre and the 3-litre, obviously the 3-litre's got more grunt. It's got more torque in particular. So certainly for towing, it's a smoother, quieter engine than the 4-cylinder. So refinement's a little bit better and that effortless grunt's a bit better. But the 2-litre twin turbo engine, which is the one you're looking at, they've recently discontinued that engine and replaced it with a less powerful, less torquey 2-litre single turbo engine, which I haven't driven that one yet. But the 2-litre twin turbo is one of the better ones of the 4-cylinder diesel utes, but the V6 has got more grunt. So I guess it depends how much you want to prioritise that grunt. Probably more important if you're towing, but as I said, there are some refinement benefits as well.
Yeah, just before you go, I'm going to buy a caravan in the next 3 years to actually live in it as my permanent home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, would the 2-litre, the twin turbo, would it tow a decent-sized van?
Yeah, it'll be fine. I mean, it's rated to tow up to 3.5 tonnes. It will be working pretty hard doing that, towing 3.5 tonnes, but it can do it if you want to. But, hopefully your van's not going to be quite that heavy, in which case you're going to have not too much of an issue. But as I said, the V6 is going to do it easier for sure.
Okay.
All right, cheers.
Thanks, Linda. Bye-bye. A couple of texts here as well. John in Canberra says, "G'day, fellas. I remember going with a mate to buy a 6-CD stacker U-Bute 6-speaker sound system for the car. The salesperson offered one kit that came with a remote control. I said, why would a remote control be handy in a car? And the salesperson said, I must not have seen much backseat action then. And Jane says, Phil, when I was 20 years old, I had a brand new Mazda 6 Sports with a boombox in the back, went to the drive-in with a new boyfriend, mattress in the back, seats down, hatch up, much more vibration from the boombox in the spare tyre than I ever expected. And the movie, 40-year-old virgin. Love the show.
Nice.
Good fun. Yeah, they're good fun. Good times, I must say. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Matthew from Brisbane. G'day, Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, how you going?
Yeah, good. What's your question?
It's rather not a question. It's just about a great car I had back in the 80s, mid-80s, and the great sound system I put into it.
Yeah. What did you put in?
It was a Kenwood.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Kenwood, yep.
Yeah, and it was the removable one.
Yeah, with the face on it. Or you could actually, some of them can remove the whole thing, couldn't you? Like, slide it all out.
Right, the whole chassis.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I was, how old was I? I was 19.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, no, look, that was an interesting thing, actually, Toby, wasn't it? Because there was a whole period when security on car sound systems was a big thing.
And I remember going to uni and having and every time I'd have to take the sound system out so no one would nick it. But I used to have a Kenwood as well, and some of the brands back then, Pioneer and Sony and all those sorts of ones were cool. But yeah, the theft was a major issue back then for sure.
Mm. Exactly. This is Motor Talk.
Nightlife with Philip Clark. On ABC Radio.
Toby Hagen is with us as well. Trevor from Harvey Bay wants advice on a new car. G'day, Trev.
Yes, good evening. I'm currently driving a 2015 Colorado, and I'm looking to upgrade it to a Musso, but I'm towing a 3,000 kg caravan. Is it going to do the job?
So I'm just trying to think with the KGM, it used to be SsangYong, obviously these days KGM, they've rebranded. The tow capacity, off the top of my head, I don't even know. I'm assuming it's 3.5.
Yes.
Yeah, so look, theoretically, yes, it should do it, but you really need to crunch the numbers because utes tend to do it better than SUVs, but obviously once you've got a 3-ton van out the back or a 3.5-ton van, you've got 350 kilograms theoretically pushing down on the back of the car, which then takes that weight off the payload. So you've got to detract that from the payload. So it can become an issue. So crunch those numbers first. And the other one you're going to have to watch out for is GCM or gross combination mass. So the weight of the car, the trailer, and everything in both of them starts to become an issue as well. So with any, if you're towing at the maximum, that will likely start to create issues in terms of your legal weights and so on. So I would very much crunch the numbers first to make sure that that you're not going to be overloaded, because that is a bit of an issue.
Okay. Never buying, I've always bought Holdens and that, and going to a Korean motor car, can you give an opinion on them at all?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Koreans...
I know price very good compared, but I know you only get what you pay for too.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit of a case you get what you pay for. But, you know, you look at the Korean brands and the two better-known ones, Hyundai and Kia, these days are absolutely, you know, considered up there with most of the Japanese brands as well. The only thing I'd say is obviously we've seen a lot of action from Chinese brands, so don't ignore them in that, I guess, more price-focused part of the ute market, because there's a lot of action going on there. We've got, you know, you've got GWM Canon and Canon Alpha, the Canon Alpha being slightly bigger, and BYD with the Shark. There's a whole bunch there that that are going to also provide a fair bit of competition for something like a Musso. So, keep in mind that. There's another one coming out later this year too, the Cherry, they've just renamed it Stockman. Named it the Stockman.
Oh, really?
Which used to be...
Suzuki's.
They used to have a Suzuki Stockman many years ago, and now they're going to have a Cherry Stockman. So it's that'll be out later in the year, and that's a pretty cool-looking thing too. If you look at it, it's got a bit of retro styling up front. Looks pretty cool. So it's, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And one of the things with that Stockman, it's going to have a plug-in hybrid diesel system, which is, never had one in Australia. So every hybrid we've had here has been petrol hybrid. It's going to be a diesel hybrid, which in that market could be quite interesting, because obviously that market is very diesel focused.
Are these things going to be keenly priced or not?
Haven't announced pricing yet, but if you look at everything else in the Cherry range, it's pretty sharply priced. And they know where it's got to sit in terms of, I would have thought somewhere kicking off in the 50-something grand mark, somewhere around there.
Okay. But, thanks, Trev. Good on you. 1-300-800-222. Toby is here. Preset, any thoughts on the new BMW iX3?
I'll be able to give you all those thoughts in about 5 or 6 weeks, because they haven't launched it locally yet. I'm just locked into it and due to drive it in late July. So it's only seen what I've seen online. But, it looks pretty sharp online. It's more expensive, obviously, than the current one. If you talk about the current one, I have driven that, the outgoing one, and obviously the new one's more expensive, better, longer range, all that sort of stuff, but as I said, haven't driven that new one yet.
Jane says, the Becker, speaking of sound systems, the Becker in my 1967 230S Benz, still works perfectly, as do the speakers.
Yeah.
There you go.
Nice.
there you go. All righty. Max has got some questions about the new RAV4. G'day, Max.
Yeah, hi, Toby. I just want to ask about the RAV4. We haven't done an air cap rating on it yet.
Mm.
So if you bought one without an air cap rating, does that cut the resale value? Does it cut the value of it? I don't know when they're going to do an air cap's done by the government, isn't it?
No, NCAP's done independently, but it does have government money behind it as well. So, but they've also got motoring club money, so NRMA, yeah. RACV, all that sort of stuff. But no, NCAP is not necessarily a government department, but does have some government funding. So no, in terms of when they're doing it, it's all a little bit odd the way that's happened. So essentially they tried to get that RAV4 into Australia late last year, at which point it would have been tested under the 2025 NCAP protocols. And right. They anticipated it would have got 5 stars. The NCAP protocols changed for 2026. The car doesn't meet the 2026 protocols yet. They won't tell us exactly what it is that doesn't meet it, but they are saying it is not to do it. It will not mean a structural change on the car. So the way the car crashes is not going to change. It sounds like it's some sort of safety assist system or a software update or something, but they're saying that they're not going to be able to update the existing cars that they're selling now. So will it impact the residual values? I don't know, and I don't think anyone can tell you that definitively until, you know, we see both of them alongside each other in the used car market to see if some people will value them more. I'd be surprised if it did because, as I said, it's not going to be a major change to the car, but the one thing it does do is a lot of big fleets in Australia have a minimum 5-star requirement, and that includes government fleets, you know, police and so on, unless they need it for specific duties, and the police and a whole bunch of other government departments do buy non-5-star cars all the time, but they say they need them for specific requirements. But yeah, it's whether it'll impact that, I'm not sure. But I'd be surprised if it did, is the short story.
Sure. Okay.
No, I just wondered, you know, they will eventually do an NCAP rating on it, won't they?
Yeah, they are. They're saying they'll do it by the end of the year, the end of this year. So in the next, you know, 4 or 5 months, we're anticipating that'll happen, and they're saying they're expecting a 5-star result. So, yeah.
There you go. Thanks, Max. Yeah, resale values. Quite a few people are texting about this too. Is there any new intel on resale values for electrics?
Yeah, it has changed quite a bit over the last few months. Mm. The market generally has changed. I was chatting to the head of Redbook, Redbook's the big valuations company attached to car sales, and was chatting to him about it as to what has changed. And he said the big thing that's changed is the demand in the EV demand in the market means that dealers in particular now feel comfortable buying electric cars. Previously, they didn't try and buy many of them because they found them hard to sell. They didn't want them sitting on the lot for too long. Now they are saying they're selling and they can make money out of them. So they're buying them, which has popped the residual values up. So, yeah, residual values on EVs has increased for sure. It is still not quite at the level of, you know, hybrids, for example, which are sort of the darlings of the used car market. But consequently, we've seen other cars come off. And he was saying that particularly diesel utes, they had a range that they were looking at. This is when I spoke to him maybe a month ago, and he said they were looking at, it was either between 8 and 15% decline in residual values
on diesel,
diesel utes by the end of this year. They said that's the range we're working towards. Wow. So he said they've already seen it drop off, and they're anticipating it'll come off more by the end of the year. So it's starting to change.
Starting to change, exactly. John from Coolum. G'day, John.
Hi, Phil, Toby. How you going?
Pretty good.
Good.
Luxury tax, Toby. You talked about luxury tax quite a while back, and I was asking about it. Have you heard any more about it, what's happening or what's going on?
The government still plans to charge it because they can make a lot of money out of it. I think they're taking $1 billion a year from it. So, luxury car tax kicks in. Two different levels, one for what they call fuel-efficient vehicles, so EVs and very low low fuel consumption cars, essentially hybrids, and the other one for everything else. So the hybrid, the fuel-efficient cars kicks in at $91,000 roughly, and the other one I think is about $75,000. So, and it's 33% over that, anything over that price cops a 33% tax. So
it's a huge impost, isn't it?
It is huge. The government loves it when people buy Ferraris and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
They think it's great.
I like that GR Sport, and I'm just thinking, if you bought a second-hand one, would you be paying luxury tax on that again?
So you're talking a Lancer as a GR Sport? Yeah. No. So luxury tax is only paid on a new car. So so it's like GST and anything else. Once you've paid it on the car up front, that's it. It's not paid again. It's already been paid, and it's built into, I guess, the residual value of the car to some extent. But no, you don't pay it again.
Okay.
That girl that you talked to before about the Everest, my son's got one of those, and I'm a 4B freak, and I could not believe how quiet that thing was as a general and how well it went. It was just
it's not the only one, though. I mean, you get into that Land Cruiser V6, and that's also an extremely smooth and quiet engine with a heap of grunt, more grunt than the old V8. So it's and diesel engines these days, yeah, they can be extremely refined. I remember I drove a Range Rover 6 or 8 months ago, and that was just incredible in terms of the refinement in it and the performance and everything. Admittedly, it's not a Range Rover engine or a Land Rover engine. It's a BMW engine, but it's a BMW diesel V8 in there, but it was very good.
Mm. Well, Simon also got a Silverado, and we went out in that the next day, and I thought, how good is this thing?
Yeah.
And my wife was panicking. She said, how do I get out of this thing?
It's a big unit. It's a big unit, John. Yeah. Mm. All right, mate. Thank you. Yes, let's move on. Phil, can you ask Toby what they're going to do with all the fossil fuel cars in 10 to 15 years' time? Crash them or just give them away?
No, I think they're just going to take their natural course like anything else.
They'll still be there.
They'll still be there, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you think, you know, still – so we talk about the growth in EVs.
Hmm.
Last month, it was roughly 20% of the market. EVs and hybrids were 46% of the market. So 54% of the market was diesel and petrol. So it's still a big chunk of the market. Hmm. Admittedly – they're coming off, particularly the petrol-only models are coming off. But yeah, you're still, you know, anyone who buys one of those cars now will get the normal lifespan out of it, whether that's 10 years, 15 right. years, 40 years, they'll get the standard lifespan out of it. So no one's going to go crushing or anything like that. They'll just let them die a normal death like they do now.
Mm. That's right. Petrol and diesel cars are going to last for as long as they continue to be made.
Many years yet.
Many, many years.
Yeah, and it's and you know, we've seen manufacturers walking back from the EV only, you know, going through the EV only phase. So they're still working.
We're still in love with hybrids, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, more in love with hybrids. So a lot of the brands are saying, okay, now we have to start thinking more hybrids than anything else.
Toyota's bet on this years ago was probably a smart one, wasn't it?
Toyota absolutely picked that hybrid market better than anyone. Yeah, and in the early 2000s, they were mocked by other car companies saying, you know, this is irrelevant technology. We don't need this stepping stone technology. We're going to go straight to electric. Toyota turned out to be right 100%. But that said, it's also, I think, fair to say that Toyota is off the pace when it comes to electric cars.
Hmm.
If you look at last month, you know, we've seen EV sales boom, as I said, 20% of the market. So an enormous amount of EVs sold. 202 of them were Toyotas last month. So Toyota sold a massive amount of cars, and 202 of them only were Toyotas, whereas, you know, other brands, Tesla did, 5,600? So it was it's a fair difference.
Yeah. Lawrence in Bundaberg. G'day, Lawrence.
Oh, hi there, guys.
Question? G'day. Questions?
My question's about small diesel SUV or small cars.
Mm-hmm.
Current drives a 2008 Polo TDI. And I like the way it dries, etc. And I'd like to upgrade it, but not to anything new. And just looking in that 2015 to 2020 in diesel with conventional manual transmission. And don't really want anything very limited, like an ASX or one of the Hyundai's.
Yeah, you certainly hit me with a challenge there, because I'm glad you're not asking about a new one, because that's almost impossible to find a manual diesel SUV these days. But in that mid-sized SUV segment, one of the few ones that still does offer a diesel is the Kia Sportage. And that, with the Hyundai that you mentioned, I would certainly stick those on the list. They're the same diesel engine, so they both get a 2-litre four-cylinder turbo diesel. And it's a pretty good engine, so definitely have a look at those. Mazda also had a pretty good diesel back then. It did have some issues. I'm not aware of how or what they fixed those issues with in terms of, I think oil use was one of the big challenges with it, but just maybe look into that a bit more before committing to it. But the Mazda one certainly performed really well, but as I said, they did have some issues with it along the way. But as I said, the Hyundai and the Kia would probably be relatively high on the list. Nissan X-Trail diesel was also pretty good back in its day, so that's probably worth a look as well.
All right, the ASX.
I'm just trying to think if ASX, did ASX have, that was predominantly petrol. I'm trying to think if they had a diesel back then. I can't.
Yeah, definitely. And okay. And in manual also.
Yeah.
You know, everything's got issues. Yep. And the old follows putting on some power, putting on some years, too much in K. But I just want to try and stick with a conventional, simple, no problematic transmissions, no expensive repairs.
Yeah.
Just something with low Ks on it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, as I said, the Hyundai and the Kia would be slightly ahead. The ASX is a smaller vehicle. It's in terms of things like the suspension, the driving dynamics weren't as sharp as some other cars back then. So, but yeah, it's yeah. I mean, it's, you know, of those SUVs back then, they did do, a lot of them did diesels back then, and quite a few also did manuals because the diesels were set up often for the European market where they were pretty keen on manuals over there.
Okay, thanks, Lawrence. This is Motor Talk. Toby Hagen is with us. Rosemary, sorry, Rosemary, you've been waiting on there. Hello.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Toby. I bought a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how good the stereo system is, which was fine. However, the radio stations default to the digital. So if I'm driving in Sydney and listening to the ABC and I go into the tunnel, it cuts out.
It disappears.
And I do it disappears. And I also do a lot of long distance driving and country driving, and the digital network is not
great.
Yeah, it's terrible. So I go for long periods, you know, half an hour, without any radio whatsoever.
That is a crisis, Rosemary. That is a crisis. No ABC radio. No, exactly.
How can I listen to you?
Rosemary, I'm a taxpayer and I demand my rights.
So, you know, that tunnel issue, and that is that is an issue, but some brands, and I think Mercedes-Benz is one of them, but some brands, if you're listening to the digital channel and you go into the tunnel, if there's an associated FM channel, it will automatically switch to the FM while you're in the tunnel, and then you come out of the tunnel and it goes back to the digital. It's almost seamless. Like you,
I know. Here's an example, Rosemary. If you listen to ABC Classic, for example, right?
Yeah.
You go in listening to digital, it'll still keep playing for you because I think somehow it switches. But all right, yeah. Otherwise,
not my car.
Okay. Depends on the car.
Depends on the car. It's not as good as you think it is.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you might have to go to podcasts and download the podcast while you're in range, listen to it while you're driving out of range, which admittedly means you can't listen to live radio,
which is a
crisis. Is a problem.
Yeah, but, especially when you live in the Southern Highlands. Anyway, yeah. That's my whinge. But cool. The BMW have not kept up with what Australian markets need, tyres, all sorts of things. Hmm. But I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rosemary.
Yeah, and it's weird with things like that. So it's funny. Are you talking about tyres being so large and not spares and that sort of stuff?
Well, we've literally had this car for 6 weeks. It blew a tyre and there wasn't a single tyre in the country. I had to replace two tyres.
Yeah.
Here we go. They just don't know about Australian conditions and Australian roads. They're building the cars for German autobahns, and it's sad. The rest of the car is fantastic, and I think the i3 will be wonderful, but I can see lots and lots of issues with the Australian market and how BMW has to pull their socks up and learn about our conditions.
I'd say it's not just BMW, it's a lot of the European brands, but I'm also going to leap tiny bit to their defense in the wheel and tire combinations. These days the trend is to go really big wheels and licorice tires around them so they look pretty cool. They're hopeless on bumpy roads. They reduce the ride. They're like, you end up with a bumpy ride, all that sort of stuff, and they're more prone to punctures and particularly if you hit a decent pothole, and they can even damage the rim and stuff with that as well. But every time they bring in tires with, I guess, smaller diameter tires with higher profile tires, they end up with them sitting in the sales in the showrooms. They can't sell them because people don't like the look of them as much. So they end up just not bringing them in. They just bring in the ones with the big wheels and tyres, which I completely agree with you, are not suited to our roads in a lot of instances, unless you're on a racetrack or something. So, yeah, it's a problem. And, look, the radio thing, that is also an issue. The two brands that used to do the best job with radio reception in Australia were Holden and Ford, because they were designing and engineering the cars here. And I remember chatting to the Ford engineers once, and they said they had a route around Melbourne CBD where they knew there were issues with reception, and they'd drive their car around and stop them in those bad areas for reception to try and improve the reception, particularly on AM. So they did all that work locally. These days, they just take what's available from overseas and say that'll do.
Yeah, I know. I agree, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Look, thank heavens. I mean, there was a whole period when I think lots of us in the radio business, you know, were worried about the fact that radio could disappear out of cars.
Mm-hmm.
Now it hasn't because of streaming. But it is
a challenge. These days, when I travel to the outback, I run a Starlink, so I've got reception everywhere, and you can stream anywhere. So you just stream radio from wherever.
Uncle Gavin's texted in saying, "Well, you can listen to the ABC on the phone through the ABC Listen app,
but you need range.
Then you Bluetooth it to your car.
Yeah, but you need reception. You need phone reception
to get it on your phone for a start. To start with.
So and that's what she was saying. She doesn't have phone reception. So it's
that's right. Yes, Gavin. A lot of the world seems to be. A lot of product makers seem to think they live in a world where everyone's got internet reception all the time. Well, that's not Australia. We don't.
Absolutely.
We do not.
Absolutely.
Okay, back to some calls here. Robert wants to talk about the X-Trail. Hello, Robert.
Oh, hello, Phil and Toby. Thanks for the show.
Pleasure. What's your question?
Wondering on Toby's opinion. I'm interested in getting into an X-Trail 2011 or 13, and just wondering Toby's opinion on, you know, are there any things to look out for vehicles like that?
So really generically speaking, with any 15-year-old car, yes, there's a lot to look out for. So obviously service history, check how it's been treated, maybe get an independent inspection to make sure that it's not got major issues. In terms of specific issues with that car, I'm not aware of any, but I don't really focus on that sort of thing too closely. So I'm not aware of specific things with those particular models. But the X-Trail back then was a pretty good thing. Probably one of its biggest competitors was something like a Mazda CX-5. Which always stood up pretty well back then. So I'd say look at that as well. But the X-Trail, yeah, back then was a pretty good car. It had some cool little extras too, things like the cooled cup holders. So they ran part of the air conditioning through the cup holders on either side of the dash. So you put your bottle of water in there and end up all icy cold, which was pretty cool.
Well, that's got to be a good thing.
It's the little things you see, Robert.
Yeah. Cheers. Thank you
Cheers,
very much.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye. Indeed. Jeff in Harvey Bay. Yes, Jeff.
Oh, good day, Phil, Toby. I'm looking to power my house from an EV overnight. I wonder what's available for a vehicle to load. I don't want power to the grid. I just want to power the house overnight.
Well, vehicle to home is what you're chasing. Mm. I mean, so there's a lot with vehicle to load at the moment, a lot of cars do that, a lot of EVs. So vehicle to load is just essentially a PowerPoint in the car. But then you need to go and run a PowerPoint from your house. So vehicle to load works brilliantly in a blackout, for example. You go and run an extension cord to your fridge and a couple of other items, and that's it. It'll work perfectly. It's not going to power the whole house. To power the house, you need vehicle to home, which is very similar to vehicle to grid, and the manufacturers are working on vehicle to grid. So you sort of, if you get one, you're going to get the other pretty much. And just today, I think Hyundai put out a press release saying they have made vehicle-to-grid work on one of their cars, an Ioniq 9, to the latest standard. So there's a government standard, and they rattled it off in the press release. But they've made that work. Hyundai and Kia plan to have vehicle-to-grid available to customers in the third quarter this year, so within a couple of months. They're going to announce something with that. So, there's a bit going on with it. Not a whole lot there at the moment. The only one that can do that fully at the moment is the Nissan Leaf, and it's probably not an EV I'd stick high on the recommendation list at this stage. So give it another 6 months, and I think you're going to start seeing a lot more happening in that space. As I said, Hyundai and Kia are on it. BYD's been doing a lot of testing. AGL, the big energy company, has been doing a lot of testing as well. and as have other companies as well, Amber and a few others. So it's there's a lot going on in that space, and within a few months, I think you'll start to see more happening. But that's all we, or that's all I know at this stage.
Okay.
So wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think if you waited till the end of the year, you'll have a lot more. You'll start to see some options. I'm not going to say there's going to be a lot of options, but you'll start to see some. The big unknown at the moment is the hardware required for the house. So it used to be quite expensive. I believe it's coming down a fair bit, but I don't know enough about that yet in terms of what needs to be done to the house with the extra hardware to enable that that sort of system.
Toby, I actually just wanted like a normal, I have a backup generator at the moment and a changeover switch.
Yep.
So if I have a blackout, I just change over to my Honda generator, but I wanted to use my car that way.
Oh, instead. Well, yeah, vehicle to load is what you're chasing then. So grab a whole bunch of Hyundais and Kias have got vehicle to load. BYDs have got vehicle to load. Many of the Chinese brands have got it. The list is pretty long in terms of the cars that offer that vehicle to load functionality. The one thing you've got to look at, two things with vehicle to load. One is the power output. So yeah, typically it's either 3.6 kilowatts or a bit more.
No, I want at least five.
Okay, so you will have to check that they've got that from a single power board or whatever. The other thing is some of them do it from a built-in PowerPoint, often in the back of the car or, you know, in the load area or something. Others do it from you have to plug a board, looks like a power board, into the charge port of the car, and then you plug your appliances into that. So just, the second one's a little bit more inconvenient, but might work better for what you're trying to achieve.
Okay. Okay. All right, Jeff.
Thanks for the info.
Thanks, mate.
Bye-bye. MG does vehicle to load as well.
Okay. Dot from Darwin. G'day, Dot.
Yes, hi. just wanted to ask you, Toby, with the BYD, I was looking at changing to the EV/hybrid. I've got a little Lexus NX 300, and it's a 2018. I've only got 90,000 Ks. Would I feel much difference between the two?
Yeah. Definitely. So you're going to see a huge difference just in the driver assistance technology. But yes, yep. You will also notice a difference. And one of the things with some of the BYDs is a Tesla, for example, you get in, it's got very immediate throttle response. So the second you do anything with the throttle, things start to happen. It takes off pretty quickly. Some of the Chinese brands, including BYD, tend not to have quite that sensitivity. So just an adjustment in terms of how you drive. But, yeah, you'll notice a big difference. The one area it'll probably go backwards on your Lexus is in driving dynamics. So the outright handling, they've still got a little bit of a way to go on that front. But in terms of performance, features, technology, space, it's going to be way ahead generally.
So would you buy that or not?
I'd have it. Are you looking at the C-Line 7 or is that the one? Yeah, so I'd definitely have it on the short list, but it's not the only one I'd have there. So Zeekr 7X is also a really good car in that market. Have a look at the Tesla Model Y. Even the Toyota BZ4X is starting to be decent value in that market. It's not going to have as much as those Chinese brands. But, all of those, for different reasons, are worth sticking on the short list.
Excellent. Thank you for help.
Thanks, Todd. Bye. See ya. Bye-bye. You've just spent a week driving a car with a yoke steering wheel.
I have.
What was it?
A Lexus RZ. So this is the...
Which you should describe what a yoke steering... This is like a Formula One
almost like an aircraft steering wheel. So it doesn't have a top on it. Yeah.
It's just got two bars on either side.
So a bar on either side, and that's all you hold on to. So there's no holding onto any part of the steering wheel.
How do you do a reverse park with that?
So it only turns 200 degrees in either direction. So a bit over half a turn is full lock. And a bit over half a turn the other way is full lock the other way.
Oh, wow.
So you never actually have to take your hand off the steering wheel to do anything, to do three-point turns, to do come out of an intersection. It takes some reprogramming from early on. So at slow speeds, at a T-intersection, my natural reaction is to go for the top of the wheel to turn it. You don't have to do that. Just keep your hands at 9 and 3.
Wow.
Give it half a turn and away you go.
Away we go.
That's a bit different.
Away we go is what we've got to do as well. Toby, time has beaten us, but it's been terrific fun. Thank you. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.